Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.
On October 9th of 1990, a ranch owner and his son were inspecting their vast property when they found the unimaginable. In the middle of their Arizona ranch were the charred remains of a one-year-old baby girl. What heartless monster could murder and burn an innocent child? Could the people responsible be found and brought to justice? This is True Crime Cast.
This is True Crime Cast. Jamie back with John. What's up, man?
Not much. Anything you want to talk about? Or are we good?
I think, I'm sure we can come up with something if we tried hard enough.
Sounds like football music, but whose song is that?
It's the Kentucky fight song, John. Kentucky and Tennessee played football this weekend.
Well, half of that's true. Kentucky came to play.
And for the first time since 1984, Kentucky won in Knoxville.
Congrats.
In impressive fashion.
Yeah. I don't think I'd seen a butt whooping that bad since the last time I backtalked my mama in middle school. One team came to play that was not the team in orange. Congrats. You deserve it. Now can we kindly move on?
Yeah, I'm not one to linger and gloat until they play next year.
Also, make sure you edit out that part where I called you a bad word.
Yeah,
I didn't see you mark it, so I just want to make sure.
I have plenty of those.
Fair enough. Oh, well, you go ahead.
No, we have people to thank, John. Thanks for tuning in today. We're done with football. It's time to get to murder, which is much more fun for Tennessee fans.
I almost said there was a murder on Saturday. Your defense came out and murdered our offense. But anyway, yeah, we got a couple people I want to thank. First off, Kristen came in at a $3 level over on Patreon, so thank you, Kristen. Also, Dana came in at a $3 level. Thank you, Dana. So if you're not familiar with Patreon, every single month over on patreon.com, you can sign up for as little as $3 a month, and that will get you access to a bonus episode every month. You can also sign up for autographs, coffee mugs, all kinds of cool stuff over there. Be sure to check that out, www.patreon.com.
Yeah, and we try to drop some bonus stuff over there every once in a while. Last week's episode came out a day early for Patreon members, and we do ad-free episodes over there. So we'd love to have you join us. If we get to 200 patrons, we're going to go and meet one of our lucky patrons.
Yeah, I'm so excited about that. So,
I'm 6 feet away.
If you live within the U.S., we would love to surprise you with a visit. So go ahead and sign up if you haven't already. Looking forward to traveling again. Traveling would be fun.
That'd be something, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
John, we cover a large variety of cases. Serial killers, small town murders. Every now and then we cover a case that's not a murder. But then we talk about crimes with kids. And that's when I want to stop doing this.
Yeah, we did one last week, and that was really difficult to get through. And sadly, today we have another one. This time it involves like a 1 to 2 year old little girl. And it is horrifying. It's awful. But I think it's a really interesting case, and we would be doing you all a disservice if we didn't talk about it. So let's roll.
I legitimately considered just walking out and making you do this whole thing on your own. So, trigger warning, it's awful, but it is very intriguing, and it's good. I don't know if you're into crime, it's certainly a different kind of one. So, John, why don't you get us rolling?
This story is really going to start on October 9th, 1990. That's when a cowboy in Arizona, first off, did you know there were still cowboys in the 90s?
Yeah, I don't know. Like, maybe he participated in rodeos. He owned a ranch, and you drive cows to...
Yeah, he owned...
City Slickers came out in the 90s.
That's true. I didn't see it. Surprise.
Dude.
I know, right?
City Slickers is good.
Anyway, so this guy, his name is Alan Kessler. He has a huge ranch outside of Phoenix, Arizona. And the property is so large that it required constant inspection. So he and his son, who is named J.P. Kessler, would saddle up and begin to patrol their property. Again, this was October 9, 1990. As they reached a really secluded part of the property located near a public road, Kessler and JP noticed that there was some trash that had been dumped in a ditch and included bags of trash and an old television set. They began to look at this trash that was on the ditch, and it really wasn't an uncommon thing. I mean, this was near a road. People would occasionally drop off stuff to dispose of it. But as they began to look closely, JB suddenly cried out that this small, charred little bundle wrapped in red and blue clothes was actually a baby. So that's what we're going to be dealing with today. Alan would later report that he was in just utter disbelief. He told JB that it was just a doll or some other something that was not actually a baby. And the scene was so horrific and unexpected that his mind just refused to believe that the burnt object was actually human. As he would say, and we see this a lot, he thought it was like a doll or, like a mannequin. And that's usually what people's brains go to instead of human body. And I think that's really interesting. I know that we've spoke about it before, but my mind, I don't know that it would automatically go to doll or mannequin rather than this is something very, very sad.
Yeah, it certainly, to me, isn't logical. It's not like mannequins are often out in the middle of the woods or on the edge of a ranch. So why would you think that would be there?
And it's just because we cover true crime and the worst of humanity every week. So maybe our minds would go in a different place than most people. I don't know. Still, as they inspected it closer, Kessler realized that it may indeed have been a baby, so he summoned for another one of his ranch hands who approached the bundle and confirmed that it was an infant. It was badly burnt, but it was still wrapped in its baby's clothes. The child had been left among trash and debris, abandoned in a desolate area of cattle pasture, and it's just an horrible and unimaginable scene that these guys walked on. The child had not been there long. There were still tire tracks that were still fresh. It was a bit of a miracle that she was actually discovered at all. At a different time of the year, the Kesslers would not have patrolled that remote part of the ranch, and it may have been rained on before they found her. I mean, it really is a horrible thing, but the timing was perfect that they found her. There's still tire prints. It hadn't rained, or else this baby, it's really sad, but there was a storm drain really close to the scene. So if it would have rained really hard, there's a chance that water could have rushed through that ditch, cleaned everything out, and we would have never have known that a child had been abandoned and burned on that property.
We talk a lot about the impact to victims in these crimes, the impact even to family members of perpetrators. We don't talk a lot about the witnesses, but just think about how that changed the lives of these two individuals to find a baby that had been killed and burned. Like, that's trauma that just does not go away, and I can't imagine walking up on that. Once his mind finally was able to comprehend what was actually happening, Kessler quickly rode back to his house and called police. For 6 years, this was a mystery, and it was obviously horrific, and it went unsolved. The local sheriff's office had no report of missing infants. Further complicating the investigation, the body was very decomposed and, like John said, very charred, and it made identification really difficult, especially when nobody seemed to be looking for a missing baby. The sheriff placed a plaster bust of baby Jane Doe, which was the name that they ended up giving to the baby, in the windows of his office to keep the community aware that they hadn't forgotten about this crime and they were still hoping to find out who committed this awful act, hoping it would eventually lead to a tip that would bring justice for the murdered infant. A forensic artist came in and produced a drawing of what the baby girl may have looked like prior to being burned, but that didn't lead to any new tips either. The only clues aside from the baby's body was a set of tire tracks John mentioned, fleeing the scene and presumably driving the mile or so back to the interstate. A partially burned sock was also found at the scene. And even as the investigation was going nowhere, Phoenix and Flagstaff residents gathered to provide a proper funeral and burial for this anonymous child. Each time that the sheriff of the town, whose name was Buck Buchanan, which is a great sheriff name.
It's like the perfect sheriff name.
Each time he walked by this child's bust in the window of his office, he said he could almost hear the baby pleading for help and crying out for justice. So this was always at the forefront of his mind, John. This is certainly not a case that you kind of say, oh, well, there are no leads, we're going to move on. Detectives combed through every birth record in the area over the last year and a half and tracked down every baby to perform a welfare check. So this is a huge investigation, not only of the crime scene, but they're going to hospital records. They're going to people's houses to make sure these babies are okay. Their hope was that they could identify the baby when one of the children that they know had been born in the area was not found at a home. But amazingly, every child that was born in the county in that year and a half was accounted for in a home. Not long after the child was discovered, and it was clear to the police that this was going to be a difficult, if not impossible, case to crack, America's Most Wanted did a segment on the case. That show, of course, is known for soliciting tips that resolve otherwise baffling cases, and we've talked about John Walsh and his son and kind of what led him into doing that on his own. But even after that segment aired on the TV show, there was no valuable information coming in about this missing, murdered child. It was 6 years before the police would hear anything that would lead them toward a resolution of this case. That's when a young man who was a social worker reported to police that his ex-girlfriend had confided in him that she had very close information about the murder of a baby a few years back.
So let's take a step back and talk about who this child was, where she came from, and then we can talk about how police were able to investigate this. So going back about a year before this baby was found burned on the ranch in Arizona, that's when we meet James and Lillian Meegan. Now, James was 33-year-old. Lillian was 29. They lived in a dirty motel room outside of Las Vegas, really far away from the really nice hotels and casinos that we see on the strip that's on TV all the time. And they lived there in a single room with their three young children. As I said, James was 33, Lillian was 29. They were poor and they struggled with sobriety. James was a large guy. He had a bad reputation for being a violent man with his family, and it didn't take a whole lot to set this guy off. The people who knew Lillian would characterize her as a sad person, that she looked fearful all the time, and I think that's because she lived with James. Now, the only income for the family was when James and or Lillian would pick up an occasional day labor job, and the family really struggled to make ends meet, to feed their three children, to have enough to really live on. In 1989, like I said, about a year before the discovery of the baby at the Arizona ranch, Lillian discovered to her horror that she was pregnant once again. She really knew that they could not support another child, and she and James both doubted whether he was the father or not. From the onset of the pregnancy, Lillian and James agreed that they did not want to be parents of yet another infant, and they began to work out a plan to ensure that they would not be the ones burdened with caring and providing for another child. So one of those plans was to enlist the help of one of Lillian's high school friends, and this was a woman named Valerie Jensen. Jensen was the exact opposite of Lillian in many ways. She had a stable home and income. She was happily married, and they already had two very happy, well-adjusted boys. Unfortunately, the Jensens wanted a third child, but doctors had told her that it'd be very dangerous for her to carry another child. So when Lillian was about 8 months pregnant, she called her old friend up. And again, this family friend lived in California. They were not really close at the time. And Lillian confided in her that she was once again pregnant and knew that Valerie had always wanted a daughter. So she made a promise. Lillian said if the baby was a girl, then she would turn it over to them for stability and happiness, but that would come at a cost.
Although it was certainly a strange deal, the Jensen family talked it over and agreed to take this child that would come from the Meegans. On December 8th, 1989, Lillian gave birth to a child, and of course it was a little girl. After the break, we'll talk about what happened once the baby girl was born and the exchange was made.
Hey guys, Jamie and John here, and we want to tell you how excited we are to be able to offer new merchandise for our podcasts.
Yeah, we have partnered with a company called TeePublic. We have listed the links to our store below in our show notes. We've also put those on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. But Jamie, there's a ton of stuff you can find over there.
T-shirts, phone cases, mugs, travel mugs, hoodies, and even masks, John.
There is a ton of new products over there. It's way better than the store we used to have. You can customize your order. Like if you want a shirt that's yellow or green or blue, whatever, you can make that happen. So go over there and check that out today, and you will not be disappointed.
Once released from the hospital, the Jensens agreed to pay the Megan family $1,000. They bought them a new car, and they helped with a down payment of their new home. In exchange, they took the girl, which the Megans had named Francine Lori Toney, but they renamed the baby Danielle. Within days of essentially selling her child, Lillian had regrets. She started calling the Jensen family incessantly, demanding the baby girl back. James wasn't on board with what Lillian was doing. He didn't want the baby back, but he continued the phone calls because he wanted to extort them for even more money. After he wrecked the car that they had bought him, he demanded they buy him another one. And within a couple months, the Jensens had paid over $30,000 in total to the Megan family. The bright side of all this, John, was that Danielle was flourishing. She was happy, well-adjusted, she was healthy, and she loved to play with her big brother. She fit in very well with the Jensen family and was very loved. On September 10th of 1990, the Megan family made another demand for more money, but this time the Jensens refused. They claimed they had already paid far more than the agreed-upon amount, and the Megans were furious. James said that he would come and take the baby girl back if they refused to pay them more. The Jensen family put up a fight to protect the child, but James became increasingly violent and aggressive. Finally, he threatened to kill the two boys in the Jensen family if Danielle was not returned to the Megans.
He said that you're going to know what it's like to lose one of your own if you don't give her back. And that is just such a crazy thing to say. I mean, this whole thing is crazy, but obviously that kind of speaks into what he was like.
Yeah, let's stop and talk about this for a minute, John. You're a social worker, kind of like the guy who reported this. You see children that end up living in homes that are not with their birth parents. I'm an adoptive father. I've adopted two kids. Like, this is not how this should go down. Like, there are ways to do private adoptions, right?
Yeah, they didn't involve the system. And, you know, 2020 hindsight, right? Like, we can look back on this now and say, this was a crazy deal. Why did this family ever agree to it? But it happened, and it still happens today. I mean, shoot, I've seen cases where kids have been sold, and thank God, like, somebody gets involved to stop it before it happens. And sometimes it's not stopped, but this is crazy stuff, man. Like, you should always, if somebody ever approaches you about taking their child, and it happens, and that's a good thing, but at least go about it in the proper way. And this was not the proper way.
So legally, if this had gone to court and a custody battle had happened, she was with the Megans, right?
Right.
Because there was no legal adoption process.
Right. Now, I think that at this, if you would have went to the authorities and got them involved, like, at least they could see and potentially stop the Megans from getting the kid back. But yeah, I mean, all rights belonged to her rightful mother.
Yeah.
And father.
And the Jensens were really scared at this point. Their sons' lives had been threatened, so they felt like they had no choice but to give baby Danielle back to James and Lillian Megan. Their neighbors at the hotel would describe Danielle's life as really less than acceptable. She would often be locked in a room by herself. They often heard her being yelled at and called a brat because she was raised in a certain way and then thrown into this situation where they were barely making ends meet and she wasn't getting the love and affection that she was used to at the Jensen home.
James Megan made it clear that he did not want this child. He seemed very angry that she was no longer bringing in so much money. One night, not long after Danielle was back, she began crying and was distraught, and nothing the couple seemed to do would calm this baby down. And look, you and I, her parents, you have like 1,000 children. I only have 2. But there are some nights that are just like that when the kids are little, and there's really nothing you can do. It's hard to deal with as a parent. But unfortunately, James went to a place that's not good. He was in pain. He was stressed out about money. And he finally snapped. He got to his feet and was hoping to quiet down the baby again. But in the process, he ended up hitting his knee. And this was apparently the final straw for this guy. He grabbed the baby by her neck and he shook her violently. Now, her crying stopped, but this was not good. She began to begin panting for breath. Lillian, the mother, attempted to do CPR on the child, but no matter what she did, the child would not respond. Although she was still alive, it would take a really long and painful death before she would die. It took almost a day before this child would die. There were no medical help called in for the child. They did not try to rush the child to the hospital. Basically, the Megans did nothing to try to help this child. When she finally died, Lillian told investigators later that she would change her diaper, she would redress her, then she would put that child in a suitcase, and her and James drove away with the child in the suitcase in the trunk of their car. As we mentioned at the top of this episode, they would drive until they hit the Arizona desert. They found a remote piece of land which was owned by the Kesslers, who eventually found this baby. James took the body out of the suitcase, poured gasoline on her, lit her on fire, and they said later that they couldn't stay there long enough to watch it burn. They just lit it on fire and left.
If you're anything like me, that's one of the more cringeworthy passages that True Crime Cast has ever put out. I don't even know where to start, John. The pain of imagining having this happen to a child is unfathomable. Some people have heard of shaken baby syndrome, where people just get, like you mentioned, it's frustrating.
Yeah.
This child's crying. I've fed it. I've changed it. I've held it. It won't stop. What do I do?
You do everything I don't know about this guy, but most families like me, you do everything you can. You make sure that they're dry, they're fed, there's nothing they physically need, but then they won't stop. And this guy snapped. You know, I can't tell you how many times I've read reports of this kind of stuff happening, and it's heartbreaking. Most of the reports that I read, they snap, but then they realize what they've done, and they'll bring the child into the hospital, and they'll make up some bullcrap story. This family did it and then didn't even try to get her help. They just let her die. It's absolutely heartbreaking and insane.
And young children are so fragile. It doesn't take very much to do lasting damage. You'd have to think if they took her immediately to the doctor that she would have had a chance to make it, because we don't know exactly what her injuries were, do we, John?
No. I mean, she would die of suffocation. You know, it was a long, hard death. And again, this child is not a brand new baby. Like, it's over a year old. So this would be a violent act to shake this baby to the point where she would become like this and then ultimately die. And what kind of sick person does it take? Listen, I'm not saying that I give this guy any credit. You're mentally unstable and you snap. I get it. I've seen it so much that I get it. But then not to spring out of that reaction and try to get her help, that takes a different kind of person. Like most people that this happens to, they take the child in and they make up a story to try to cover what they've done, but they at least try to get the child help. This guy watched his child die, and it took a day, 24 hours. You think about how long a minute is, how many minutes are in a day. This guy watched his child suffer for 24 hours. It takes a different kind of person and a very sick individual to be doing this to a child and then watch it suffer for that long. Like, I'm going to stop there.
Yeah, it's a very different kind of evil, and again, unfathomable. And I don't know, you would think that somebody would talk, and they did. The case finally came to light, like you mentioned earlier. Lillian's sister confided in her boyfriend what had happened to Danielle. And that was the guy that was a social worker. He called police. He waited months, however, and only did it after he had broken up with this woman because he didn't want to put his own life in danger. By the time it was reported, it was 1996, which is 6 years after the baby was killed. He reported it to the police where he lived, and it took a diligent citizen, the wife of one of the deputies who responded to the scene, who remembered reading about the dead child many years ago, to kind of connect the two, connect this report with the article she had written about this baby that was found 6 years earlier in 1990. Once that citizen notified police, authorities started to put the pieces together and really investigate James and Lily and Megan. Police knocked on their door and questioned them, and James refused to look at a photo of the baby.
Yeah, the investigator, they brought him in for questioning after they were interviewed at home, and both people gave two completely different accounts. Like, the mom said, yeah, we had a baby who was taken from our car in Las Vegas. We never saw her again. We didn't go to police because we were afraid that whoever did it would try to come after us. Well, the dad completely denied that he knew about any of this. He just knew that one day he had a daughter and the next day he didn't. So they brought him in for questioning. The police put a picture of his daughter in front of him, and he, like, recoiled. So his body language was very evident that he knew and was responsible for what had happened to his daughter.
Yeah, like you said, they told police a variety of stories, and it was quickly proven that those were all false. They couldn't produce any, at least Lillian couldn't produce any evidence that she had an actual living child. Police arrested them on drug charges at first so that they can continue to build their murder case about Danielle's death. Finally, Lillian would cave in and confess everything to police. The couple would reach a plea deal in which they would plead guilty, and Lillian would walk free. And in this deal, James would only get 10 years of prison time. John, we talk a lot about plea deals. Sometimes they may be necessary for police to get evidence to convict somebody who commits a crime. You offer somebody else a plea deal to testify. How legitimate is that? Are people telling the truth? All kinds of questions there. But what world do we live in where these two people get a plea deal in the first place, and part of the agreement is for one of these people to walk free? What happens in Vegas is apparently awful.
I mean, listen, a lot of the cases that I've seen, there's nobody charged, so at least they're charged here. But this is an awful, awful plea deal. I mean, I can't imagine being a prosecutor and being okay with something like this. I mean, they brutally murdered this child. They let her suffer for over a day. In my book, I'm not convinced that I'm happy unless both people are never getting out of jail again, but especially James.
And they set the baby on fire.
Yeah. I mean, I don't even want to think about that. So yeah. I took that out of the equation.
Right. Like, how on earth? Thankfully, this plea deal did not actually happen. So as angered as you were when I said it out loud, take a breath. James ultimately backed out of the deal and went to trial. So it was stupid for them to offer this deal. How stupid is he to not take it?
I don't understand,
man. What's he think's going to happen?
I mean, I guess because so much time had passed, maybe he was hopeful that they couldn't, like, 100% prove that it was him. You know, you're innocent until proven guilty. Well, there's a lot of things that have happened since then. There's no body anymore. She's already buried. So I don't know, man. I don't know what he was thinking. Obviously, he's not a very logical human being anyway, right. So I'm not going to give him the opportunity to... I'm not going to speak on his behalf for this.
Well, because he backed out of the deal, Lillian didn't have a deal in place either. They went to trial. Lillian ultimately got 18 years for failing to call for medical help and for child abuse. And James would be sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. And John reported that as soon as he was sentenced, the next moment he got, he tried to kill himself.
Yeah, well... At the trial, the Jensens testified against their one-time friends and told them everything that had happened. Lillian defended her husband and at one time even said that they lit the body on fire because they simply wanted to have her cremated. But Lillian also told investigators that they lit her on fire and she couldn't stand to watch it, so they left before they would see if it had actually burnt the body up, and it didn't. The Megan's other children defended them. They said that the child's death was an accident. James Megan has been continually denied parole. He remains incarcerated. This case has been featured on several different things. Cold Case Files on Netflix was one of them, and that's over there now. It's season 1, episode 1. I think it does a really good summary of this case. So you'll have to check that out if you are interested in that kind of thing. Man, I tell you, because of what I do, this is horrific, but I've seen pretty similar things to this just through what I do, but not to the extent of trying to hide the body and burn the body and stuff like that. But I had some, like, I don't know, PTSD flashbacks of my time having to read all these investigations and these kinds of cases. So it was hard for me. I'd imagine it was really hard for you to talk about.
Yeah, I mean, just being a parent, and any time we've had a child involved, you always comment that I kind of retreat and sit here on my phone while you're talking about things. I certainly did that a lot today. I just, like, murder is an evil that I can't understand, but murdering children is an evil that actually scares me that it exists.
Yeah. It, this world is sick, man. There's some sick people here for sure. We always talk about, was justice served? I'm glad that we didn't end this case on that stupid plea deal, because I would be just irate. I don't know why he thought that it would be a good idea not to take the plea deal. Thankfully, he chose not to, and now he will never spend another day outside of prison. He will never be free. She is probably already free. I mean, she only got 18 years, and that was over 18 years ago.
Yeah.
So she's out, presumably living a life. And so I'm not okay with that, be honest with you. So was justice served for this sweet child? No, because one of the people responsible is not still in jail.
Yeah, absolutely. She should be in jail for the rest of her life as well. And unfortunately, John, this is an awful tragedy. This is something that's hard to talk about and hard to think about. This stuff happens, I don't know if every day, but this is a very common occurrence of people who don't want their babies choosing to, like, we hear about babies being found in dumpsters and that kind of thing. And we're not getting into a pro-choice, pro-life debate. We're talking about children that exists autonomously outside of the body being killed. And it's just, man, I don't want to talk about it anymore. So thanks for sticking with us through this. If you were able to, no kids getting murdered next week. I'll commit to that.
I don't know what we're doing next week, so I can't make that promise, but I promise you that I hope we're done for a little while. So yeah, thanks, Jamie, for doing this one. I know it was tough. Thank you all for checking in with us each and every week. We hope that you enjoy the content that we're providing. If you do, please take a moment to like and subscribe over on iTunes so you never miss an episode. We've been known to do a bonus episode in the middle of the week, and if you're not subscribed, you may miss that. Also, a rating and a review would be very appreciated.
Yeah, we have merchandise available. I actually just ordered a new package full of stuff for myself. So masks, cups, phone cases for True Crime Cast and our other show, Bless Their Hearts. So feel free, if you do have merchandise from us, send us a picture of you wearing it or using it. We'd love to see that.
I saw a picture come in from our friend from across the pond, Joe, and her daughter were wearing some True Crime Cast shirts. Joe, thank you so much for sending that picture. We appreciate your support. And guys, I think that's it. If you want to buy a shirt, you can go visit our Facebook and Twitter page. We've pinned that at the top. So it's tpublic.com. There's a link, like I said, on Facebook and Twitter. That's all I got, man. So until next crime, this has been True Crime Cast.
You've listened to True Crime Cast, distributed by Stoveleg Media. Check out Stoveleg.com to find out more about your hosts and to find other podcasts to listen to. Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.